I'm about to have auto-laryngectomize myself from a lot of talking. I come to these meetings and I get so passionate about talking to so many individuals that are here that I admire, that have been mentors over the years, and that I'm humbled to be a co-panelist with people like Howard and many others that are too numerous to mention. So if my elocution suffers, please forgive me. I also would like to specifically give a shout out of thanks to my mother who is here. If not for her many years and my beloved deceased father's many years of selfless sacrifice and hard work, there's no way I'd be doing 99% of what I'm able to do. So thanks. So I'm going to provide you a little bit of historical perspective, and this all has to be done in 20 minutes. So I may talk a little bit quickly, and if I start getting a little roadrunner on you, just wave your hands in the air. I'm going to try to give you a little bit of historical perspective on some of the racial disparities and from where they arose in the United States and worldwide, and then talk about current disparities, be they economic, criminal justice system involvement, healthcare outcomes, and so on. And some of this information will be familiar to you, and perhaps some not. This is why it's hard to get the Native Americans to want to celebrate Columbus Day. And this is from Christopher Columbus's journal when he met the Arawaks when he first landed in the Bahamas. They brought us many things. They willingly traded everything they owned. They do not bear arms. They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. I'm going to put this up here. Yeah, I don't want to end up disconnecting this, but I'm too tall for the mic. So, do you mind if I just do that? Yeah, and then I'm going to kind of go like this. Otherwise, I can't read. Can I just take this? Would you mind if I take this off? All duct taped together. This is a high class operation. I'm going to go all Phil Donahue on you then and walk with the money. Okay. Okay. And I should also say that this slideshow, as well as about 150 other open access PowerPoints, are all on my website and are freely available, so there's no need to take notes. So from Columbus, we go to Sir Geoffrey Amherst, he of the town of Amherst, Amherst University, who plotted to inoculate Native Americans with smallpox by giving them blankets to, as he said, extirpate this execrable race. So what he lacked in compassion, he made up for in alliteration. And then Winston Churchill, this was when he spoke out in favor of the Royal Air Force's experimental bombing of Iraqis in the 1920s, which killed 9,000 people with 97 tons of bombs. And he said, "I am strongly in favor of using poison gas against uncivilized tribes to spread a lively terror against recalcitrant Arabs as an experiment." You probably didn't see that in the opening ceremonies of the Olympics. And then Cecil Rhodes, he of the Rhodes Scholarship, Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, the De Beers Mining Company. "We must find new lands from which we can easily obtain raw materials and at the same time exploit the cheap slave labor that is available from the natives of the colonies. The colonies would also provide a dumping ground for the surplus goods produced in our factories." And this, of course, we see on many levels today. Well, we have the history of slavery, we have the history of apartheid, no time to go through that. We, of course, went through some of the triumphs of the civil rights era, but as you'll see, much has not changed here in the United States and abroad. There's also the World War II and post-World War II history of the Tuskegee syphilis study, during which over 400 African Americans were left untreated to study the natural history of syphilis in blacks, which was thought to differ from the natural history of syphilis in whites, sponsored by the Public Health Service, only stopped in 1972 when it was brought to light by a reporter and inevitably led to a certain number of deaths, and depending on what estimates you believe, it's anywhere from 30 up. But most people who rupture syphilitic aortic aneurysms don't get autopsied and are just written down as cardiopulmonary arrest. And then, of course, the Guatemalan syphilis study, which came to light most recently. There's a whole slideshow on the website. And I'm sorry, I keep coming in and out, which is probably incredibly annoying. It does. Okay. The Guatemalan Civil Study. So exploitation leads to a number of things, three of which we're not going to have much time for today. Maldistribution of wealth and resources, environmental degradation, and wars. And there are slideshows dealing with this on the website also if you're interested in learning more. But let's look at economic disparities first. So the median income of black U.S. families as a percentage of white families has really not changed. 60% in 1968, 59% in 2010. It's 69% for Hispanic families, but essentially no change. We also know that minorities face higher levels of unemployment. And the recent recession and housing crisis has hit particularly hard black and Latino families more than white families, and minorities are more likely to live in substandard housing and in racially segregated communities. Today, 14% of U.S. residents and 20% of children live in poverty, and the rates of poverty in blacks and Hispanics are almost three times those in whites. And of course, poverty is associated with worse physical and mental health outcomes on a number of levels. This I stole from PNHP, this looks at family income and net worth, comparing whites, which is the blue bar, and blacks and Hispanics lumped together. On the left-hand side, you'll see family income, and there's certainly a discrepancy there, but the great discrepancy comes in net worth, $113,000 for whites versus just $6,100 for blacks and Hispanics. Now, income inequality within a country is associated with a number of adverse consequences, not only for the poor, but also for the rich in those countries. And these consequences include lower life expectancy, higher rates of infant and child mortality, shorter height, poorer self-reported health, higher rates of AIDS, depression, mental illness, obesity. And Voltaire had it right many years ago, however, when he said, the comfort of the rich rests upon an abundance of the poor. And we're seeing that especially today. And nowhere have I seen this more visually better demonstrated than in this photograph from the crash landing of U.S. Airways on the Hudson River. And you can see coach class versus first class. As I mentioned, minorities tend to live in segregated communities. They suffer the stress that's consequent to ongoing racism and poverty. They are faced with voter suppression measures, which are particularly in the news as the election comes up, and millions potentially disenfranchised by current movements on behalf primarily of the moneyed interests of the right wing of this country. And undocumented immigrants face particularly high levels of stress due to the constant threat of deportation and potential disruption of familial and social relationships. Now, your average xenophobic, racist, firearm fetishizing, science denying, flat earth nutcase will say, well, you know, we don't want these undocumented immigrants here. They don't pay taxes. I don't want my tax money going to support them. But the reality is that even undocumented immigrants pay a significant number of taxes. They pay state and local income taxes, property and excise taxes, the employer's share of Social Security when the employer, in fact, acknowledges that there are these people working for them, and of course taxes on items that they purchase in stores where there's state and local taxes. But they are not eligible for many of the public services that these tax dollars fund, such as Medicaid, SNAP, Social Security, Medicare, unemployment benefits, temporary cash assistance, and so on. And if you look at the dollars that are put into the U.S. economy by undocumented immigrants, not only in terms of taxes paid, but other benefits to the U.S. economy, and you look at the amount of money that they take back, overall they're providing a large net benefit. And the best place to find the information on this is the Oregon Center for Public Policy, which has done an analysis of this. The problem is those dollars aren't equitably distributed by the federal government back to the states. So if you're living in California, Illinois, New York, Florida, then the undocumented immigrants are probably taking more out of the state than they're providing. On the other hand, if you live in any of the rednecky states, you're probably getting a lot more back in money from the undocumented immigrants, and you should be a staunch proponent of as much undocumented immigration as possible. There's also a ongoing educational apartheid and high levels of de facto school segregation by both race and socioeconomic status, gross discrepancies between neighborhoods in per pupil spending and in teacher salaries, and as a result, both the achievement gaps and the graduation gaps continue to grow. And we know the better the education you have, the better your health. The bars here refer to those the percentage of adults that rate their health as poor. And you can see if you've had less than high school, you're talking about 26% through the college educated at just about 6%. And we'll talk more about education in a few moments. You're also, as a racial or ethnic minority, more likely to suffer from environmental racism. So polluting factories, waste dumps, incinerators are found more commonly in lower SES and in minority neighborhoods, places like the Cancer Belt between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And as a result, the poor African Americans, Hispanics, and others are more commonly exposed to lead, mercury, and other toxins. In terms of healthcare coverage, if you look at the percent uninsured, 12% among whites, 17% Asians, 21% African Americans, and 32% Hispanics, and of course 100% among undocumented immigrants, with an exception for emergency care. And back in the 90s, Prop 189 was passed. Many of you will remember that here from California. It basically required the visa biopsy of all healthcare institutions before patients could be seen, essentially turning healthcare providers into immigration cops. It was held up basically in the courts the day after it passed, and it never became law because it was ultimately overturned. But there was a wonderful study that was carried out looking at mental health care visits to the outpatient setting over the month following the passage of Prop 189. And what they found is that outpatient visits among undocumented immigrants went way down, and approximately 3 to 4 weeks later, inpatient admissions started to rise because, of course, people didn't go to their psychiatric appointments, didn't get their meds, and as a result ended up getting hospitalized. So even if one were to ignore most moral arguments and bioethical arguments and adopt a simple Ayn Randian sort of selfish ethic about the care of undocumented immigrants, it's in everyone's best interest to provide health care for these individuals, just from one example alone, and that is that the average patient with pulmonary tuberculosis will infect 20 other individuals. So if we're denying those people care, it's in our own self-interest, regardless of our where we stand on the political spectrum, to provide health care for these individuals. Other disparities include higher maternal and infant mortality rates, higher death rates for most diseases, shorter life expectancies for African Americans, not for Hispanic Americans, and there are certain reasons for that. And minorities tend to undergo fewer diagnostic tests and therapeutic procedures, which sometimes is not a bad thing with modern medicine, but they're also less likely to be treated in the emergency room with adequate pain medication. If you look at Latinos specifically, they have higher rates of all of these conditions, from overweight and obesity through stroke, HIV, AIDS, and homicide. And this study was one of the ones that really struck me as to the importance of public health versus medical science. And as you know, there was a schism in the early part of the 20th century between medical education and public health education, and the two fields have never really rejoined. But what the researchers did here, and I'm not too familiar with their methodology, but they looked at all the medical advances that were made over a one-decade period and how many lives that was expected to save. And this is all new drugs, all new surgical procedures, et cetera. And they found that those medical advances averted about 176,000 deaths, whereas if they were to just have simply equalized black-white mortality ratios, the number was almost fourfold higher in terms of the number of deaths that would have been averted. So there's two ways to look at causes of death. We can look at cause of death attributable things like low education, racial segregation, poverty. You're not going to see this taught in medical schools. What you're going to see taught is this: death attributable to acute myocardial infarction, stroke, lung cancer, and it's not broken out by social causes. So I want to come back to education for a moment. For every $1 that's spent on early childhood education, up to $17 are saved from increased school achievement, improved health, reduced crime, reduced reliance on public assistance, and your income goes up 11% for every year of education. And yet we have one of the worst educational systems in the industrialized world in the United States, and it's so pathetic that a quarter of public high schools have no library. We know that college graduates live 5 years longer than high school dropouts. And eliminating educational inequalities in the United States would have saved 8 times as many lives as medical advances from 1996 to 2002. Again, similar kind of attention to the social contributors to health and illness. In the criminal justice system, there also exists significant racism. Persons of color are more likely than whites to be stopped by police, driving while black, arrested, denied bail, charged with a serious crime, and receive a harsher sentence for the exact same criminal offense. African Americans in this incarceration nation in which we live suffer very high detention rates, and there are more black men behind bars today than there are in college, and 13% of black men currently have lost their voting privileges, essentially disenfranchised. Latino Americans also high rates of incarcerations, and then the lowest rates among Asian Americans. So I also stole this from PNHP, thus making my own personal crime record not clean. But this was a very interesting study in which a researcher sent a well-groomed applicant, black and white, to apply for jobs. They had the exact same resume, except one resume had a felony cocaine conviction and the other didn't. And what they found was these are the percent that were called back for an interview. So the significant finding here is that you are more likely to be called back for an interview if you are a white applicant with a felony cocaine conviction than if you were a black applicant with the same resume but without the felony cocaine conviction. Well, we know things are horrible outside the U.S. too, so I don't want to minimize the problems that exist in the world with racial and cultural inequalities, poverty, famine, war, and governments and corporations promoting poverty and worsening the maldistribution of wealth and resources through things like trade agreements, internalization of profits, and externalization of healthcare and environmental costs. As a result of the third world debt crisis, each African child that's born, it comes into life already $379 in debt, which is a significant amount of money if you're living in sub-Saharan Africa. And countries spend more money each year repaying the debt that they owe to the first world than they spend on education and healthcare combined. As a consequence of trade and debt repayment agreements, governments tend to cut spending on necessary items like food and fuel and farming subsidies, healthcare and education, and in turn will start stripping and selling their natural resources. So for instance, China is just grabbing up land in sub-Saharan Africa to plant crops to treat the Chinese. Forests are being cut down. Gas is being produced in Nigeria and elsewhere, and enormous human rights abuses taking place consequent to that production. So some people have heard this talk come back to me, and they say, well, you know, the U.S. is a great country. We make up for this in foreign aid. We give a lot of money. And it's true, in total dollars, we're number one in the world, but as a percent of our GDP, we're number 21. And much of this aid goes to benefit U.S. corporations that are headquartered abroad, so the money is given as, quote, foreign aid to an American company that goes and builds a dam or a factory, brings in some American consultants. The job's completed, a few jobs are provided for the local population, but most of the money ends up flowing right back out of the other country. And if you poll Americans, the response that you'll get is that they think about 24% of our federal budget goes toward foreign aid, where in reality it's just 0.9% of the total budget and 1.6% of the discretionary budget. So we're not all that generous. And so then some people say, well, it's not up to the government to provide aid. We make up for that in charitable contributions. And unfortunately, today charitable giving is at 2.5% of people's income, and actually that figure has not changed from before the recession. People were giving a higher percentage of their income at the height of the Great Depression compared to what they're giving now. So charitable giving is not going to make up the difference. As many of the other speakers at this conference have noted, the U.S. has contributed to these disparities by failing to sign or to ratify a number of international agreements, the Kyoto Protocol, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, CEDAW, the Persistent Organic Pollutants Treatment, the WHO International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes. We fail to follow world court decisions. We don't recognize the International Criminal Court. We basically are saying, we're gonna go it alone, and to heck with the rest of the world. But I think it's important to remember the words of someone like Primo Levi, the writer and Holocaust survivor, and he said a country is considered the more civilized, the more the wisdom and efficiencies of its laws hinder a weak man from becoming too weak or a powerful one too powerful. And so I'm going to end with just some solutions for what we can do about this. Certainly we need a more equitable distribution of research funds and healthcare dollars, and we need to stop the brain drain that we're promoting of talented healthcare professionals from the developing world back to the United States where we do not need them. We need to pass living wage laws such as they have in a number of cities in this country already. We need reform in the education system and a lot of money put into high quality schools. We need the creation of healthier communities and stronger environmental and occupational and safety laws that actually get enforced and have some teeth behind them. We need a single-payer system, and nowhere is this better demonstrated than the fact that if you're black and you're Canadian, you're as healthy as if you're white and you're Canadian, because everyone has access to health care. And I think worldwide, the solution to much of these problems revolves around improving the status of women and confronting their social, their legal, their political, and their economic marginalization and their impaired access to reproductive health services. And we need to overhaul immigration policy, change law enforcement sentencing guidelines, and we need publicly financed campaigns and campaign finance reform that has some teeth. And new ways of thinking about how we elected our officials, things like proportional representation, instant runoff voting, so we don't have to go into the voting booth, hold our nose, and pick the evil of two lessers. And unfortunately, those who are most affected by policies of government are least likely to vote. So whites vote more often than blacks and Hispanics. The old vote more often than the young. Owners vote more often than renters. And doctors, I hate to say, are in one of the lowest voting professional groups if you look at all the those with advanced degrees. And we need to work in groups. So I'll leave you with the words of Nobel Prize winning author Günter Grass. The first job of a citizen is to keep your mouth open. And I'm not done. If you think you're too small to have an impact, just try going to bed with a mosquito in your tent. So it's a privilege to be here among so many people that I idolize so much, and thank you for allowing me to be on this panel and share my thoughts.